We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview. The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Good morning. It is Tuesday, August 27th, and we are just rocking and rolling in pumpkin spice latte season. If you are as excited about that as I am, I was saying there are different essences of the pumpkin spice. It's not just what you go out and get at your, you know, Starbucks or your Dunkin' or whatever coffee shop you prefer. And they're all very different, by the way. Here in Florida, we have Joffrey's Coffee, which is also has a really distinct pumpkin spice. And then there's the essence of the pumpkin spice coffee that my Nespresso has this morning. And then, you know, you add a little bit of the vanilla syrup and nutmeg on top. And it's just fall delicious. And I know for people saying it's like 90 degrees still in Florida, it is still the end of August. I am still celebrating all things autumn and pumpkin spice season. And I appreciate those who also celebrate. So happy pumpkin spice season to all who celebrate. And if you don't, you know, that is totally your choice. And you can just be sad without your coffee and that'll be okay. All right. Well, let's rant for just a moment on the issue of life, because this is such at the heart of everything that we do and we stand for as Christians, that are founded in truth and understand that truth is the person of God. And so our worldview reflects that, and everything that we do in our family government, our church government, and also our civil government must reflect that truth and be in accordance with God. And God is the one that gives us life. He has made all human beings in His image. And so we are all created with inherent dignity and worth. And this is why from the moment of conception all the way until natural death, life must be preserved and protected from the taking or the foreclosing of innocent life without due process and by the government, particularly in the context of abortion regulation. It is not for the government to say, you know, this is exclusively between a woman and her doctor or woman and her massage therapist, as Amendment 4 here in Florida wants to suggest, or, you know, a woman on her own. Even this is about the government's legitimate interest in protecting the life of the unborn child, as much as the government has an interest in protecting your or my life or the life of the mother. So these are issues that have been at the heart of every conservative Christian, and especially Christian organization. It's one of the main platforms here at AFA. It's one of our main issues that we stand for. And then there are other organizations like, for example, Live Action and my friend Lila Rose, who does such an excellent job over there. That's literally their one issue. That's it. That's their entire organization is built to advance in public policy protections for life. So in the midst of the GOP watering down their platform and Trump, unfortunately, pushing out the Truth Social post saying that he will be a great president for, quote, reproductive services, whatever. I mean, that's just... People want to suggest that, you know, oh, he just means IVF. He just means, you know, reproductive health services, that, you know, that he doesn't mean abortion. Well, yeah, he does, because nobody except leftists uses the term reproductive health at all, or reproductive rights. That is a term that the leftists have used to try to encompass abortion within all of these other genuine healthcare services for women who are pregnant or want to become pregnant, not who want to get an abortion. So so Lila Rose and Live Action, of course, have been posting on social media that they disagree with this. And that's the right position. And regardless of, you know, what you think about Trump versus Kamala or Democrats versus Republicans or left versus right on anything else, on the issue of abortion, they are correct. Why? Because our standard is not the GOP or the Democrats or Trump versus Kamala. Our standard is the truth of the Word of God. And when anyone runs afoul of that or does not reflect that truth and the policy position that stems forth from that, then we can and should, as Christians, first and foremost, say that that is wrong. That is the incorrect position. We disagree with that, and we want to advocate against that. But so many influencers who are very concerned that Trump may lose the 2020 election, and I hear that. I don't want, you know, the communists to prevail. I get that. I mean, I fully support a Judeo-Christian worldview in every position from president all the way down to dog catcher, right? But for the people who are very concerned about this, instead of being very concerned that it's the GOP that is watering down one of the foremost issues and the pinnacle of the first rights that we have as human beings, because without life we can't exercise or have any other rights, they're now going and attacking Live Action and Lila Rose and, you know, one influencer who I know personally, you know, who doesn't even call herself a Christian, I don't even think is genuinely conservative, you know, more libertarian, and I think is pretty open about that, you know, is now posting at Lila Rose saying, you know, if you can come and explain your Live Action financial disclosures and you can explain, you know, your salaries for your staff and all of these things. And I'm thinking, what are you doing? That's not going to win over any pro-life voter or anyone who I know is a bulk, if not 99.99% of our AFR family that is very concerned about life, and rightly so. That's not winning over anybody. I know that their concern for what Lila Rose and Live Action is posting, and basically what she's saying is that Trump and the GOP haven't earned the votes of pro-lifers. And I think she's right to say that. They haven't earned that. Now, does that necessarily mean that Lila Rose isn't voting for Trump? I don't know. I haven't asked her. Does that mean that life is the only issue? No. But it is a paramount issue. And in that respect, she's correct that the GOP and Trump making those statements is not earning the vote of pro-lifers. And we can and we should call that out without all of these other influencers saying, you know, oh, stop. And, you know, you're not winning over anybody. And we just got to be OK with whatever, because the contrast against, you know, against Kamala is just so much more important. And, you know, and then I even saw someone who posted and said, well, you think Kamala is going to be better on life? That's a fallacy. That's not the argument. Lila Rose is not suggesting she's going and supporting Kamala Harris because Trump is posting that he'll be the best president for reproductive rights. That's not what's going on here. What's going on is that she's saying to the party that should be standing for traditional values, historically has stood for that until this year, has had a federal constitutional amendment for protecting life in their platform and also in the states, and we've come off of this historic win of overturning Roe versus Wade, then they're backing off. She's rightly calling them out. And so my question here and the purpose of this rant is to say we shouldn't be going after Live Action and saying, you know, well, what are you guys doing? I mean, I've seen people even saying, well, you know, how much have you really done for the pro-life issue? I mean, that's literally their whole mission, right? And that's literally what a lot of these organizations have done for the past 50 years. Live Action hasn't been in existence that long. But for people like, you know, FRC and AFA, I mean, we have all been pushing for life since Roe versus Wade in 1973. This has been a foundational issue. And so to attack them for their issue and to say, how dare you call out the people who are now watering down your issue? You need to just go along with it and say, oh, it's fine. Oh, it's fine. Because as long as you run a little bit to the right of Kamala Harris, then we'll support you. We'll be okay. That's not going to be their position, nor should it be their position. Now, when it comes down to the pragmatic decision of who you end up voting for on the ballot, it's a closed universe situation. You do have either the better or the best of two evils, or the one that is better than the other. There's the better choice. Some people are super happy to support and think it's the best choice, right? But we always have a closed universe situation. But that doesn't mean that we can't rightly call out Trump and the GOP. And so I'm very discouraged that a lot of these influencers are suggesting to Lila Rose that she shouldn't be standing firm for life just because Kamala Harris isn't any better on it. That isn't our standard. And if our standard becomes just who is a little bit better than the communist, well, then we're not standing for anything and we're not standing for truth anymore. We have to keep our standard as the person of truth, the word of God, and God himself, and contrast everything to that. Yes, will a vote come down to pragmatism and executing our duty as stewards as faithfully as we can in this election? Yes, and I think everyone should vote. Get out, vote your values. Our value fundamentally is truth and the biblical worldview. Vote as close as you can to that. But that doesn't mean that we just stop talking to the GOP and say, as long as you're going a little bit to the right, we're fine and you've somehow earned our vote. No. I don't think the GOP has earned the vote of any conservative on that issue. And we need to continue to point that out, because how many moderates has the GOP really won over by watering down? Like, absolutely zero. Nobody is coming over from a pro-life position going, oh, you know, Trump posted on Truth Social he's going to be the best president for reproductive rights. Oh, you know what? That convinces me. Well, no. But it is losing a lot of people who for pro-life, that is their one issue. And there are a lot of voters that is actually a singular issue, and they may not exercise their vote pragmatically. So what is the point? And I think that Lila Rose and every Christian who wants to stand up for truth and wants to continue to tell not just the GOP, but also the Democrats, I mean, anybody running, we need to constantly tell them where they run afoul of the standard of truth and where they get it right as well. When the GOP, even if the left, I mean, occasionally the Democrats just, you know, they stab in the dark and they get something right, and I will tell them, wow, you got that right. More of that. That's great. Because imagine if we had everybody running, that it wasn't the lesser of two evils. It was like, who's the best of the best? That's where we should be in America. And unfortunately, that's where we're not. All right, so let's get to this, and we're going to have to extend the segment just for a couple of minutes here, Devin, and I appreciate that, because I do want to play Dan Bongino's opening statement, which is almost 4 minutes, and this is so important because we have memory hold the attempt of the assassination on Donald Trump, and somehow the media is unwilling to cover this, and I remember when I was there and actually working and for Trump and was representing him during the first impeachment. I remember that years ago. And it was 24/7 nonstop coverage for months. Nobody could talk about literally anything else. And that was negative attention toward him. But now that it might be possibly positive in the sense that we feel bad for him, we're wondering what happened, all of that has now been memory hold. They can't even spend 5 minutes. So yesterday at Heritage, and we previewed this with Representative Biggs yesterday, Heritage Foundation held a forum that had several people testifying, including Dan Bongino, who's former Secret Service, knows the job intimately, to testify what their opinions are on all of this. And he had just an absolute banger of an opening statement. And so we're going to highlight this and listen to this from the Heritage Foundation. This is cut one.
Listen, let's just get right to the point. This was an apocalyptic security failure. A man was murdered in front of his family. Three people were shot on live television, including President Trump, and the head who came within 2 millimeters of having his head explode on national television in front of millions of people. There's no sugarcoating it. It's no time for BS. Unfortunately, as Congressman Crane and Mills both indicated, the story seems to have been vanquished to the phantom zone of media coverage. It's amazing how we're still talking about JFK's assassination, but nobody seems to want to talk about President Trump being shot in the head on national television, despite the fact that we have no answers. So I have 5 minutes, so I want to keep it quick, and I want to make 3 points. I worked in the Secret Service for 12 years. I loved it. I worked with some really amazing men and women who gave everything. I mean, a couple of them literally gave everything. I know guys who've gotten bizarre diseases overseas, like chikungunya fever and protection operations. Everybody gave a little bit of something in the Secret Service, and it was a real honor to say I was part of it. But they have three institutional problems, I believe, in the macro, will help us get to the bottom of how this Secret Service apocalyptic failure won't happen again. First, they have a technology problem. The joke in the Secret Service, which is sadly no longer funny when I was there, and it wasn't funny then either, is they rely on yesterday's technology tomorrow. Think about that. Yesterday's technology, tomorrow. Everything from computer systems that waste agents' times, filling out time and attendance records they were doing, to Congressman Crane and I discussing the fact that they only implemented slings, a technology as old as the wheel, about, I don't know, 5 or 6 years into my time in the Secret Service, which is embarrassing. The weaponry was old, everything was old. These are things I would have talked about sooner if they didn't create a security crisis, and I obviously didn't want to air them publicly. Now you're seeing what happens when you don't have a drone up at a site you could have bought for $39.99 on Amazon. Second, another adage in the Secret Service, you've heard even the new acting director discuss, is the more with less approach. There is no more with less, there's less with less, okay? The Secret Service more with less approach only works if you produce more. That's how capitalism works. You produce a flat screen TV that was probably 20 years ago, $10,000, it's $200 at Walmart now. They produce a better TV with less. That's not what the Secret Service did. They produced less with more. They were given more money and produced less. A 20-year-old criminal outsmarted them on a $40 drone technology piece of device. You're telling me that's more with less? That's disgusting. That's nothing with less. That's less with more. Their budget went up. You guys know you're appropriators. You know that. Third, and I'll wrap it up with this, turn it over to Mr. Prince. The investigative mission, the Secret Service, that they're telling you they need to make them better agents is total crap. That's garbage. Their agents are talented, smart people. They can figure out how to do protection without running out cheap $20 counterfeit notes at 7-Eleven on a Friday night while the president's getting shot in the head. How is it we have a DEA, we have an FBI, we have TIGTA, the IRS, CBP, and 1,000 other entities with a $6 trillion budget, which I know a lot of you guys have been fighting against this grotesque spending. $3 billion goes to the Secret Service, and we're wasting time running out counterfeit notes. It's a serious problem, counterfeiting. Granted, it might be a legacy item. They started doing counterfeiting. That's not what we do now. Get rid of the investigative mission, turn it over to other people, let them do what they do best and should do best. Protection, thanks a lot for your time. Thank you for doing this. Thanks to the panelists as well and everyone attending. Appreciate it.
And that was amazing in terms of what came out at that hearing yesterday. I would encourage everyone to go on Rumble, YouTube, social media. Heritage Foundation has posted clips. If you can't listen to the entire about 2-hour presentation, which if you can, you should, at least listen to some of these clips because the questions that they're asking and about the failures are so important. And this would be true whether it was Trump or Biden or anybody else, any other protected principal that was the target of this attempt to assassination. We as the American public deserve to know why the institution of the Secret Service had such terrible failures that day. So shout out to the Heritage Foundation for hosting that forum. A really great job, and we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. A recent study reports that the rapidly declining global birth rate will lead to a major population crisis if birth rates continue to decline. Their massive support for Planned Parenthood is all part of their plan. While we may feel hopeless in the constant attack on life, there is an amazing way to fight back. When they shout abortion, we shout life. Preborn is leading the way. Every day, their network rescues 200 babies. When a mother meets her baby on ultrasound and hears the heartbeat, a baby's chance at life doubles. The ultrasound is the secret weapon that joins a mother's heart to her child. Preborn provides ultrasounds for clinics in the highest abortion areas. Can we join hands nationwide for life? One ultrasound is just $28, but any gift will help. $5,000 will underwrite ultrasounds for an entire network for a day. All gifts are tax deductible. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or visit preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, the Justice Department is seeking to revive the Trump documents case and defending the role of the special counsel. And so the DOJ has appealed the invalidation of the Smith appointment and the dismissal of the indictment. So I want to start there with our next guest, Josh Hammer, who is a lawyer, and he is also the senior editor at large for Newsweek and the host of the Josh Hammer Show. Just always does so much. So, Josh, a good morning, and thanks so much for joining.
Jenna, thanks for having me. I appreciate it as always.
Yeah, so I want to get into everything going on in the Middle East, but first, does the DOJ have any shot in the dark of actually reviving this documents case?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to dismiss that out of hand. I mean, they have a shot. I think it's a losing argument. I mean, if you want to just play this actually out in real pragmatic terms, how this works, I mean, Smith is appealing his dismissal to the 11th Circuit, which is the federal court that sits over Florida, Georgia, and Alabama. That is a center-right court. It is a court that is definitely controlled by a majority of Republican-nominated judicial nominees, but I mean, it's not like the most lopsided court in the country. So, for example, the Eighth Circuit, which sits over states like Arkansas, Missouri, Iowa, Minnesota, the Eighth Circuit is just a truly lopsided Republican to Democratic majority when it comes to the you know, judges don't have partisan labels, as you know, Jenna. I'm talking here about the partisan identity of the president who nominated the judges. But by contrast, the 11th Circuit is a Republican nominated majority, but it's only a narrow majority. So the way this works in practice is, you know, I assume it's the same in every circuit. I clerked on the Fifth Circuit myself 6 years ago, which is the federal appeals court that sits over Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi. And on the Fifth Circuit, which is based in New Orleans, there is quite literally a random number generator. And I'm not exaggerating. This is actually how they determine the composition of appellate panels. There's a literal random number generator that randomly assigns judges to these panels. I assume it's something similar, if not identical, in the 11th Circuit and all throughout the country. So I say all that for context, because it's possible that Smith could just truly luck out and get a very liberal panel, but the odds are against him because this is a right of center court. More importantly, the actual law is against Jack Smith, as Clarence Thomas explains quite wonderfully in his concurring opinion in the Trump versus United States immunity case back on July 1st, and as Judge Aileen Cannon thoughtfully and carefully applied to the facts of Smith's case in her 93-page, I believe it was, ruling that dismissed Smith's prosecution out of hand. So I think it's a losing argument. Perhaps most importantly, for electoral purposes, there's just no chance that this is going to happen, like zero chance this is going to happen anytime before the election. So from that perspective, it's kind of a moot point, but, you know, it's something of a Hail Mary, I guess, from Jack Smith.
Yeah, and all of that makes sense. And, you know, we're going to be watching this, of course, with great interest. And, you know, theoretically, I mean, just kind of walking this down to the possible conclusions, if Trump is elected in November and then gets to appoint his own attorney general, I mean, the cases there then are effectively dead. And also the DOJ has had, you know, internal guidance for a while that says that they won't prosecute a sitting president. But so let's just say that happens. Is it possible, though, that if this is suspended for the next 4 years, that if we get a Democrat or maybe even an anti-Trump Republican or whoever in the 4 years after that it could be revived? Or is that even not a theoretical possibility because of perhaps, you know, statutes of limitations or things of that nature?
Yeah, I'd have to look at the statute of limitations for the Espionage Act, to be honest with you, Jenna. I'm not entirely sure off the top of my head what exactly that is. But, you know, let's recall that is the actual relevant statutory basis that Smith is basing his Mar-a-Lago classified documents prosecution on. The Espionage Act was a statute passed in the context of World War I. It was a controversial statute from the moment it passed. past. It kind of came in the context of the first Red Scare, the World War One era Red Scare, when Woodrow Wilson was president. It was a statute that was always opposed by old school civil libertarians, the old school ACLU organizations like that, before all those once venerable center-left institutions started to become more woke than they actually were liberal. But, you know, the old school liberals, folks like Jonathan Turley, Alan Dershowitz, have always objected to the Espionage Act on First Amendment free speech infringement grounds. More generally, this is the kind of statute that prosecutors typically invoke when it comes to people like Julian Assange, like Bradley Manning, Chelsea Manning, whatever we're calling Manning these days. I mean, this is not the kind of statute that you would ever think to invoke against a public official, let alone a former president of the United States, over a document dispute. So from that perspective, this has always been utterly ludicrous on its face, and I would be very skeptical that this thing would get revived if it is actually quashed here.
And I'm speaking with Josh Hammer, who's the senior editor at large for Newsweek, a host of The Josh Hammer Show. And you can follow him on X, and you should, read what he writes. Always some really interesting content there. And you're hearing Todd and Copper in the background, because I think there's an Amazon guy at my door. So they're saying hi this morning as well and lauding Josh for all of his great opinions. But let's turn to the Middle East. And, one of the headlines here is that from an Israeli source, and this is coming from allisrael.com, our friend Joel Rosenberg's publication, that the IDF can launch a preemptive strike or strikes across the region. The Pentagon says that the Iran threat isn't over. This has been kind of pending now, I think, a little longer than a lot of us originally anticipated or projected. Where are we at with the situation in the Middle East in terms of particularly the threat potentially from Iran?
Well, Jenna, the immediate pressing news, this broke literally 4 to 5 minutes ago while I was on the radio with you, actually, is that the IDF has actually just rescued a brand new hostage. I saw this in my social media feeds. This is wonderful news. Qaid Farhan Al-Qadi, age 52, was apparently just rescued by the IDF in a daring mission literally today. So he's in stable medical conditions. That's another daring hostage operation by the IDF based on their intel. So that's truly breaking news while I'm on the radio with you. So that is a wonderful time and moment for rejoicing, certainly for the people of Israel. But
yes,
where it stands more generally with the situation with Hezbollah, I agree with you. I am also shocked, frankly, at how long this took to escalate following the twin assassinations within 12 hours, roughly, of each other, of Ismail Haniyeh, the top Hamas head in Tehran, and then Fuad Shakur, the number two and number three official in Hezbollah back in Beirut. All that happened within literally 12 hours of each other toward the end of July. By the way, the top Hezbollah official who we believe Israel took out there in Beirut, they don't officially claim credit for it. That's not what Israel does, but we have all reason to believe that it was them. You know, it's worth reiterating for the listeners here that Fuad Shakur was the guy who was considered the mastermind of the Beirut barracks bombings back in the early 1980s that killed 241 U.S. Marines during Ronald Reagan's first term in Lebanon. So that is someone who the FBI has had a $5 million bounty, I believe is the name. I believe that's the value. $5 million bounty on his head for quite literally decades. And that is the guy that the IDF took out last month. So, you know, I think that this is an important assassination for people who always say, oh, you know, what does the United States ever get out of the U.S.-Israel relationship? Well, I mean, this is about as concrete as a deliverable as I could possibly imagine. Someone who the FBI has had a literal $5 million bounty on his head for decades that apparently are American special ops just didn't want to take out or didn't know where he was, and the IDF took him out. But in any event, I digress. So Hezbollah did take a longer time to retaliate for that assassination than any of us had anticipated. And over the weekend, what you saw was Israel apparently got some intelligence indicating that Hezbollah was ready to launch a serious strike, including going after facilities in the Tel Aviv area, which is the most populous city in Israel. So they launched a pretty heavy preemptive strike. The number that was reported was it was 100 Israeli Air Force fighter jets went into Lebanon to take out some some rocket launch facilities. And, you know, the scary part of Hezbollah compared to Hamas is that they are a much, much more sophisticated proxy militia organization. They have over 100,000 precision guided missiles that are directly supplied by Iran. Unlike Hamas, which simply gets funding from Iran, Hezbollah is a true Iranian proxy. They are truly controlled by Iran. And they've been Iran's cat's paw for the past 40, 50 years or so. So it's a very volatile situation. Right now, it looks like Hassan Nasrallah, who's the head of Hezbollah, is not necessarily planning a further escalation. At the end of the day, Jenna, I think that he knows and understands that if Israel really wanted to, they have the technical and military know-how and capability to essentially wipe out all of southern Lebanon if need be. I mean, as serious an arsenal as Hezbollah has, Israel obviously has an order of magnitude superior military. So I think at the end of the day, this is not going to lead to a full-scale war, because I think neither side rationally at the end of the day really wants to.
Wow. Well, and you know, and where are we at with the United States policy in this? I mean, we've been talking about this for a while, but it was interesting to me that Kamala Harris actually addressed Israel and even mentioned support on the stage of the DNC and said that Israel has the right to defend itself, especially with all of the anti-Israel protesters outside of the DNC. So were you convinced at all of her support for Israel?
You know, Jenna, shameless plug. I'm putting the finishing touches on my book manuscript right now, Israel and Civilization, The Fate of the Jewish Nation and the Destiny of the West, out in March 2025. And I actually speak about in my book directly what Kamala Harris did in her convention speech. She did kind of the most trite and hackneyed line in all of U.S. foreign policy political speeches, where she said, "I defend the right of Israel to exist and to secure itself." I have such an issue with this line that politicians of both parties do, but primarily Democrats do it here. I mean, how belittling and demeaning. Like, would you ever say that about any other country in the world? Like, would you ever try to prove your pro-Poland bona fides by saying, "I support Poland's right to exist," or try to show that you're a Japanophile by saying that Japan has a right to secure and defend itself? I mean, like, what does that even mean? I mean, that is the lowest possible threshold. You're literally saying that this is an actual nation state that has the ability to exist as a nation state. I mean, I'm sorry, but that is not supporting Israel in any concrete terms. And by contrast, when she turned the conversation to her speech on Thursday to the Palestinian Arabs, you know, that is when the whole arena, the crowd started erupting in cheers there. So I am not buying it. I certainly hope that people who support strong U.S.-Israel relations, as I believe any believing Christian or Jew should, I certainly hope that no one in that position is buying what she is selling, because the record, unfortunately, dramatically undermines her purported rhetorical approach.
Well, I think that was a very robust response and well said, because you're absolutely right, Josh Hammer, that, you know, to say something as trite and vague, really, I mean, all of her policies are extremely and incredibly vague, is almost insulting. And so I look forward to your book, and give us the title one more time and when it comes out.
Sure. So it's called Israel and Civilization, The Fate of the Jewish Nation and the Destiny of the West. It's not due out until March 18th, 2025, but, you know, put it on your note card for now. Make a reminder of it. I'm putting
absolutely
finishing touches on the manuscript, and it's going to be a good one, Jenna.
Oh, absolutely. Well, everything you write is always worth reading. So, Josh Hammer, really appreciate it. We'll look forward to that book. You can give people a coupon for Christmas to go buy it after after it comes out. And we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And one of the other issues that we stand firmly 4 as a reflection of truth, and Genesis 1:27, which is that God created us male and female as an immutable characteristic, is to stand firmly that men cannot participate in women's sports. That seems very obvious, very concrete, and yet here in 2024, here we are debating, you know, what is a woman, and you know, the left doesn't really know. But the Supreme Court, thankfully, has recently weighed in on this when the U.S. Department of Education asked the court to partially stay the Fifth Circuit's and the Sixth Circuit's orders preliminarily, meaning not. Completely, but just a preliminary injunction and enjoining the rule. And when the Department of Education asked to be able to enforce the unchallenged parts of the rule of Title IX, the Supreme Court denied that request. So that was a huge win. And Florida, my home state now, really love living here, has led the way in preserving the integrity of women's sports. And Florida passed the Fairness in Women's Sports Act before many states were even talking about the issue. So joining me now to discuss all of this and how to continue on a state level, regardless of what happens in the presidential election, but to continue to make states free and fair, is the Commissioner of Education in Florida, Manny Diaz Jr. So a good morning, sir, and thanks so much for everything you're doing for the free state of Florida.
Good morning, Jenna, and thank you for having me, and welcome. I hadn't had a chance. Welcome to the state of Florida. And it's
Thank
great
you.
Having you here, but it is completely absurd that we're in a world where we have to even have this conversation. But as you said, in Florida, we've led the way. We had the Protecting the Women's Sports Act, thanks to the leadership of Governor DeSantis. We're protecting private spaces like bathrooms and locker rooms, which girls and women should not have to worry about men going in there and what goes on when that happens. And of course, making sure that our girls and our women have the opportunity to participate in sports. This is, you know, 1972, Title IX was passed by an elected Congress, signed by a duly elected president to protect women, and it was a game changer. And now the Biden administration, through unelected bureaucrats, thought that they could just change the law, you know, using a rule. And we were right from the beginning under the leadership of Governor DeSantis standing in the way. We just got an injunction from the 11th Circuit because we didn't get an injunction at the northern court in Alabama, along with Alabama, Georgia, and South Carolina. So we had to go to the 11th. But there's a few of these injunctions. As you can say, there's numerous lawsuits to put a stop to this. The best way to do this is for states to protect their sovereignty, and states have laws that are passed by legislatures and signed by governors protecting women, protecting girls, and the federal government just doesn't have a right to pretend that doesn't exist.
Yeah, so well said. And protecting state sovereignty is one of the best things that I think that the DeSantis administration is showing. And how it doesn't even matter what absurdity the federal government is proposing or attempting to do, you all will say, well, not on our watch, and we will take the aspects of federalism that are built into our U.S. Constitution to ensure that Floridians are protected regardless. Why aren't more states taking these types of notes? I mean, we have governors that are Republican in quite a few other states, and they're not standing up as firmly against the federal government. Some are. I mean, you know, we have the attorney general Andrew Bailey from the great state of Missouri on all the time. He's doing some great work. I mean, you know, not to say that Florida is the only one doing it, but I think the model here and how much you're doing across so many different subject matters really is remarkable.
Yeah, look, as a former high school government teacher, I can tell you it's refreshing to have a governor who understands federalism and who's able to stand up for states' rights. This thing is not supposed to be flipped the other way around. It's supposed to be the states that have their power, except the ones that are enumerated. And again, I think, look, sometimes there's a lack of courage. Obviously, Governor Ron DeSantis does not lack courage. And when it comes to these issues, he not only has the courage, but he has the understanding as a well-trained attorney to fight this and understands what our founders meant. But I think it's important for all leaders in all of the states to, number one, obviously protect women and girls, right? That's clear. That's a moral responsibility that we have. But number two, the other part of this that's important is to protect state sovereignty and not to allow the federal government, or especially the Biden administration, the Kamala Harris administration, to pretend like we have a national government or a monarchy. We don't have that. We have federalism. States have rights under the Constitution. But the only one that's going to enforce that or push back are the leadership in those states. And so I think everywhere where you see that you have Republican conservative leaders with courage, they're pushing back. Obviously, here in Florida, our governors push back on every single one of these issues. But we need to see more and more states do that. And understand that it's not a political issue. It's an issue of our governance and the way the system is set up.
Yeah, so well said, Commissioner Diaz, that this isn't just a matter of being Republican versus Democrat. This is a matter of understanding the U.S. Constitution as written and the specific limited emphasis on limited powers given to the federal government, and then what is reserved to the states and to the people. And Florida is exemplary in that. I mean, we have a governor who actually understands his state constitution and is using the powers that he has effectively to push back. And I truly believe that if more red states understood that and were willing to challenge the federal government when they are overreaching, then it wouldn't be nearly as drastic of a situation of a potential Kamala Harris administration when we're talking about, you know, things that are actually Marxist and communist in terms of not just education, but overriding parental rights. I mean, all of these things that are so important, because you would have people in place in the states that will push back and say, not on our watch. And one of the reasons that I moved to Florida is because if we get to a point where we have an actual communist in terms of their policies in office, I want to be in a state that I know that my rights are protected from the top level of the states. And I have confidence here in Florida that that Governor DeSantis's administration and also the composition of the voters here will protect that. So let's contrast this, though, on the other side with Donald Trump, when he said that one of the things he would do in office is to dismantle the federal Department of Education. I think that is the constitutional position. I think I wish that he had done that in his first term. What would that actually look like for the states? And do you support that type of aspect of federalism?
Well, to be clear, number one, I support it. I think the Department of Education was a mistake. The education is left to the states, and states have the responsibility of educating their populace, of making sure that they are able to uphold this republic that's made up of states, as we just continue the theme of what people should know. And I think that, you know, people say, well, all of the funding, the funding that has been really used in a perverse manner by the left to try to impose policies on states through the federal government, those things should just be turned into the title grants should just be turned into block grants. That agency can easily be dismantled from a cabinet agency. It should be to a pass through, just the management of these block grants, making sure the states get them, making sure they meet deadlines and things like that. There's no need for it to be a cabinet agency. If you look at the things that the Department of Education has done, especially under the Biden-Harris administration, is just create chaos and try to impose this cultural Marxism into our system. And that's not necessary. And again, it's not necessary if we have a conservative administration either. States have departments of education. There's ways to get these title funds out there and into the schools where they need to have effect. And in fact, if you look at all the money that's been spent from the federal level, spending, if you compare our, you know, spending on education across the world, we're spending so much money, and in most places, we're not getting the return. So that's not working. And try to impose it from a federal level doesn't work in a country this size, or the fact that we have federalism. So it needs to be eliminated and needs to be just reduced to the size of just processing those grants.
Yeah, really well said, and I could not agree more. And I think that you're right that people and voters need to understand what this actually means, because a lot of the pushback that I'm seeing in the mainstream media and, you know, from some of these influencers on social media, for example, is, well, if you eliminate the Federal Department of Education, you know, look at all of this money that goes to the states, and we can't possibly dismantle that because the states actually need that. But in a large sense, it currently, all of that funding from federal dollars comes with strings attached. And why should it? I mean, if a lot of the budget for states comes from the federal government, then there really isn't a sovereignty in terms of your own decision making. Then you're beholden to whatever the federal government wants you to do, rather than being independent, just like a campaign is beholden to its donors most often. And, you know, can they do things not in accordance with the donors? Well, sometimes. But when federal dollars come with those strings attached, then it ultimately erodes state sovereignty. So how has Florida, even in the midst of the Federal Department of Education existing and all of these other things from the Biden administration, like men and women sports and the cultural Marxism that they're wanting to put into the public education curriculum, how has Florida developed a model to stand up so well that other states can replicate?
And look, under Governor DeSantis' leadership, I think it is the blueprint, right? We talked about protecting girls and women's sports, girls and women's private spaces, locker rooms and bathrooms. But we also talk about protecting our classrooms, right? When we're talking about teachers, rogue teachers trying to insert, or teachers unions trying to insert critical race theory, trying to insert gender ideology. We have banned all of that in our K-12 system in Florida. It's not allowed. We have standards. And one thing that people forget is, you know, when they're talking about teachers take on a contract. They're public employees, right? They're employees of the school districts, an appendage of the state. And so they're public employees. They are there to teach standards. They're not there to indoctrinate or make up their own standards or provide their own worldview to students. And I think that's an important part of the formula. Getting back to the basics of teaching science, math, reading, a true social studies, civics, that's what's important, not all of this other stuff that has been really pushed in. Look, this is, Jenna, we're at the forefront of the battle of the second move from Marxism, right? The first move was the Cold War. They tried it through economic means. They tried it in several places. It's failed. So now they're trying to do it through all of these theories, critical race theory, gender ideology, all of these things to create division amongst our population. That's what they're trying to do. All of this is rooted in Marxism. It's all Marxism, and they disguise it. So that doesn't belong into any of our schools, especially ones being funded by our taxpayers. And so that's how you protect. We protect that in Florida from keeping out of our school system, from staying to the basics, from making sure that what our students is learning is the core of education, which is what parents want. And then, you know, providing school choice when it's not working, having a universal school choice here in Florida, the largest school choice program in the country by far, allowing parents to make that decision of where, you know, what setting fits best for that individual student. And sometimes people have multiple kids and they go to different settings, different schools, because We focus on the individual student here, Jenna, and not the collective. The collective, that doesn't work. We have to understand that these are individual human beings. And so I think those pillars are what have made Florida successful in pushing back and continuing to make sure our education works. We're number one in education 2 years in a row by U.S. News and World Report. We're number one in education freedom by Heritage Foundation. We're number one in the Parent Power Index by the Center for Educational Reform 2 years in a row. None of that happens by accident, Jenna.
Yeah, and just so well said. And I'm speaking with Commissioner Manny Diaz Jr. You can follow him on X. I would encourage you to do so at COMM Manny Diaz Jr. and follow along with all of the important announcements and other information that he gives out on X. And you know, it was just so brilliantly articulated how cultural Marxism is being embedded into our public institutions and how kids are being treated as communities instead of individuals, which which as we know from the biblical truthful worldview, every human being is individually created by God and has special gifts and talents, and you have to educate children individually and raise them up in the way that they have in terms of their gifts and talents. That's why I was so grateful to my parents for homeschooling, because we got that kind of individual attention. But I would just say that if your commissioner of education in your state cannot express cultural Marxism and the definition and why it is not appropriate in schools as well as Manny Diaz did just now, then you shouldn't have that commissioner, because every public officer, especially those in education, should be able to speak as clearly and understand what the ideology is that goes into these curricula is. And so really appreciate everything that Governor DeSantis's administration is doing. Thanks so much for joining. We're already out of time. Would love to have you on again. You can always reach me and my team, Jenna at AFR.net. We'll see you tomorrow morning. We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.